This is the Visual Developers Podcast with your hosts, Lacey Kessler, Matt Varghese, and Ben Parker. Interviews, no-code reviews, tutorials, and more, we're here to talk about all things no-code.
Hey, everybody. Ben here, back with another episode of Visual Dev FM. We're excited to be back, and today we're going to talk about best build strategies for when you're working with Webflow. Like, how can you really optimize your site as you're building it and kind of avoid some of the common pitfalls or mistakes that a lot of people make? And so looking forward to that conversation. But before we get there, I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Matt and Lacey.
Heyo.
And before we get there, we're obviously going to jump into what's new in no code and our no code roundup. So let's get started. We were out last week, but we're back, and so we've got quite a bit to cover here in the roundup. And hope you'll stick with us here. Webflow announced their Webflow World Tour winners, and they had a few different categories. The best business or e-commerce prototype was a Zoom prototype submitted by Sarkis. And if you haven't seen it, it is really cool. You need to definitely take a look, because there's like a part of a Mac OS rebuild in here. It's very interesting and interactive and a pretty cool rebuild. So definitely worth checking out. The best enterprise solution was from FinSuite. It's funny that like this is a no code maker day piece, because this is actually very code heavy. This was a demo or a prototype of what the designer would look like if you could integrate with your own server, like where you want to post forms. What he had is he had some developers build a server-side processing for forms for him. So that way when forms are posted, we get processed in Heroku or whatever app they're using. That sends the information along by email, but then it also adds it to an Airtable or does what have you. So a lot of different options there, but it was for enterprise, and that's really, really cool. Maybe we need to talk about server-side form processing sometime, because I love that.
That is definitely a more complex topic. But the one interesting thing there on the FinSuite side of things is I saw Joe posts on Facebook. I know the dreaded F word, but I saw Joe post on Facebook, and he was like, he said that if people voted for it, because there was voting, right? Like community voting. He said if people voted for it and it won, then he would actually build it for people. And so I'm excited to see what comes of it. Joe usually is good about his promises, so I can keep my eye out for that.
I'm curious about that, about doing that. You know, it's very... I'm curious to see the approach to it, right? Because it's like, how are you sending those form submissions, and do they need to go to Airtable? How can you configure that? It's like essentially you are building your own version of Zapier, but just a with a different face on it, right? I've built some form processing stuff in the past, I find it to be really entertaining. It's been something I've considered for a while. My problem with it is, like, then you have to keep up with it. And what if you change use cases? And what if I don't want to use Airtable? And what if I, you know, I don't know.
How do you define form processing, out of curiosity? Is this like a manipulation of form data to go where you want, or?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Like, can you, I have like an idea of what you're talking about, but can you like break that down further?
Yeah. So like you're writing code that sits on a server and it sits behind a wall that people can't access, so they can't see what's happening back there, and it's code that runs. So basically when you hit that form submit button, the action that you're putting in there, it posts to that server, and then it takes those values from the front end and processes it through the back end. And so like you can send an email with all the variables in there that get submitted and dump that to someone and send it to somebody's email address. Or one of the things he mentioned is you could literally then, okay, after that, let's go ahead and make an API call too and post it to Airtable or post it wherever. The problem is, like, you know, now you have to configure that API call for whatever field somebody has. And then you have to build a front end on top of it. So literally he is building like a quick, simple and replacement for Zapier or something like that, right? Which is It's really cool. And if you have a business where it's like, yeah, we're always going to submit forms, they're going to have fields that are similar to this, and they're always going to go into Airtable, it makes a lot of sense. But if like you have a lot of varied use cases, it could be really like, it's going to be hard to be Zapier. But it is really cool. I really loved the, I loved the concept for it. Best integration or add-on came from Vivek Shukla. So it was a script in a project to generate PDFs from a Webflow site. So you could like say, sign this PDF, and people could like put in information or fill out a information, and then it would generate a PDF based on what was happening on the page, which was pretty cool. That was, once again, this was with code, right? Which is pretty neat. Best social impact project was Steam Cycle, which was a kind of a nonprofit social impact site that helped repurpose, unused or unneeded tech devices to support under-resourced students. There was a best portfolio or side project called The Mountaineer from Amit Patel. And this was a community website for travelers to connect with one another, which was, if you haven't seen it, I love the aesthetics of this site. It looks really cool. Best clone project or use of a pre-built template was Shariar Azad of Evan, and he rebuilt his portfolio using Webflow, which was it was pretty neat. So like they had all these different categories, and if you took place in Maker Day or just hung out, like I think the Webflow team did a really good job organizing. Biased because I work with them, but I think they did a great job, and it was super fun. I actually, and one day during Maker Day, I jumped into the Discord and jumped into the chat and hung out with folks and had some conversations, and it was good connecting. So if you took place, it was really, I hope you had fun. I thought it was really cool. And you can still, I think, dev post where all the submissions were added. I think you can still go see all those. So if you want to go see everybody's projects, we'll try to find that room for you. So that was a Webflow World Tour. From Webflow. Also from Webflow, a couple of really cool, like three really cool things that I personally find awesome. The first is people won't care about as much, roughly, because they just don't think about it. But Webflow is now provides you the ability to control font display settings. So for faster loading. One thing that people use when they're using custom fonts is a font display property. And what it helps prevent is that flash of unstyled text that kind of pops up on the page. But then if you're loading that custom font, those things just won't render as quickly as screen readers and other things. It can really mess with them. And so this allows you to use a swap, which will load the font quicker, works a little bit better. So go check that out. You can read, we have a link to the release update in the show notes. So link in the show notes, go check that out. But then also my favorite is the built-in text accessibility contrast checker. So you can select some text, and if you pull up the swatch, the color swatch, it will tell you whether you fail, whether you're AA, AAA, right? Like how good the contrast is on the text versus the background. So if you're really working on building accessible websites and making sure your colors are going to work for people who may have, visual impairments, this is a great tool, a great thing to have. I personally have been using third-party tools to do this while I build. And so like having to jump out of the designer and then like open another tool and put in my color values and check those to make sure they pass and it's where I want it to be, and then go back to Webflow and make adjustments, was really, it ate a lot of time.
I feel like 2020 was this year where like we just saw a bunch of Webflow updates around accessibility, and I love it. Cause I feel like every episodes or so at least, we're talking about a Webflow accessibility update, and it's just great to see. That's honestly something we should do an episode about soon enough, building a no-code app accessibility in mind.
Yeah, I would love to.
Bring Kat back on again and like let her help us walk through what that means.
Yeah.
For those of you listening who don't know Kat is, she's the CEO and founder of Stark, and they provide accessibility tools for designers And so that would be super fun to, cause I'm all about it. And we did an episode with her earlier this year, but that would be fun too, to pick her brain on that. Pick her brain. I hate that. I hate that terminology, but you know, ask her
what I mean. Get her wisdom from it. Yeah, no, 1,000%. And I could probably twist an arm and get somebody from the Webflow accessibility team to come on too. But yeah, it's super cool. And if you use it, when you open up the swatch, it actually shows you, like, not only can you see the pass-fail grade, but if you see the selector in the swatch and it shows you the lines and it shows you where, like, it moves up to AA, triple A. And so you can kind of move it and see, like, oh, I've got to move it all the way up here or over here to get it to pass. It's a really cool visual tool and I love it. So definitely worth checking out. Webflow is listed as one of the top 100 private cloud companies, which is really cool. This is a list from like Forbes, Bessemer, Salesforce, a couple others. Link in the show notes if you want to learn more about that, but it's like a really big deal. And super cool to see Webflow on that list. Also on that list, Airtable, Zapier, Figma. So lots of quite a few no-code tools on that list of the top 100 private cloud companies. So congrats to everybody who made that list. That's really cool. Glide apps. And once again, we are the official unofficial Glide podcast. I like to say it. Glide released another course on building your own custom tasks and project management app. And I'm pretty sure that it was Jack Vaughn who tweeted about that. And so link to his tweet in the show notes if you want to go check out that course. It looks really, really awesome. I actually have it bookmarked because I plan on going through it pretty soon. So they had that. And they also released the ability for you to release your own personal app, which is really cool. So, you know, when you can publish apps for, you know, public with email, for password, they added an option for just me. So if you wanted to build an app and just have you getting access to that, you could do that. So, you know, maybe you want to have your own private journal app or whatever you might want to do. You can build an app just for you and use Glide to do that, which is really cool. Oh, that was a really nice release. Adalo. So Adalo, there are two things in our outline. I'm coming back to those, both of you, by the way. Coming back to those. Adalo had a make a clone challenge. And so, you know, we talked with David not too long ago, but one of the things they added recently was the ability for people to submit clonable apps. Kind of like you have Webflow clonable websites. And so the winners were a real estate app, an app with expandable menus, one with profile avatars, and there was a blog app. And so links in the show notes to this thread where you can go see all the winners and all the honorable mentions and click those links and go check out those clonables. If you've been thinking about diving into Adalo and you've been wondering, like, I just don't know where to get started, I'd love to see how some people do this. Go hit the clonable section of Adalo and go start checking out some of these apps, because they're super incredible. I did this just this past weekend. I kind of was poking around and looking at some of them, and a lot of brilliant stuff there. And I feel like I personally learned a lot. So it was really cool. So go check that out. The other thing is Adalo, since we last aired, has shared a couple of 2-Minute Tuesdays highlighting some new components. One is the stopwatch component. So if you wanted to have like the ability for people to have a timer or a stopwatch in app, you can do that. And another is a Lottie component. And this was actually built by the folks at Minimum Studio. So I think we talked about them early on. Can you have a career as a visual developer? I think that was the episode where we mentioned like they had a job posting where they were looking for somebody who was a visual developer. So great folks at Minimum Studio. They built that component. So go check it out. Airtable. I can't believe we let this fall this far down the list. I can't believe I didn't put it up higher on the list. But Airtable raises $185 million. My gosh. I know Lacey posted this. This was my first seeing it. And we have a Slack channel that we talk in, and she posted the link, and it blew my mind. I was like, whoa, $185 million. And then they announced some new features, which are super cool. So let's talk about these for a second. The first is they announced automations. So if you want to build on, like they have these, think of it almost like Zapier. Like you have these triggers and actions to build custom notifications or create an assign. Like if somebody changes the status to in progress, then go ahead and assign it to X. Or like if it's like, oh, it goes to content review. Oh, who's the person who does content review on our team? This person. So let's go ahead and assign it to them. So you can have these actions that you can have taking place in your Airtable without ever having to involve a third party tool, which is pretty incredible to think about. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around like being able to do that in Airtable. So my plan is this weekend to spend like a lot of time playing with this. Well, the other thing is they also have Airtable apps now. And they have the blocks, like you can create JavaScript apps and now you can use apps from the community, or if you can write JavaScript, you can build your own app and share it with the community. As somebody who likes writing some JavaScript, I've been thinking of some fun things that I can do in an Airtable. In fact, I can see a whole Airtable episode in our very near future where we talk about some of these things, because they seem so incredible. And the last thing is the thing that I think I personally am just the most excited about and I can't quite get over, which is Airtable Sync. And it's the ability to link your bases together to create kind of like this own, like think about being able to dump purchases from a Webflow e-commerce site into a table, but then link that data to another base that you share with the client where you've used JavaScript and built these apps and these different pieces. And you have a dashboard, you know, that would be really, really amazing. So, you know, having that would be, I don't know. I'm really excited about the ability to kind of build those dashboards and have those pieces. But then just think about like, okay, status changed, like this shipped. Now it gets assigned to, or it's like ready for shipment, it's processed. So like this person's going to ship it, and having your own e-commerce dashboard built in Airtable, going to be super cool. So I'm ready to dive into these.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, huge congratulations to Airtable for Airtable Sync, for Airtable's funding. That's how excited I am about Sync. I said congrats for the Sync and not the funding. Airtable Sync is interesting because I was reading up on it, and it seems almost, and I'd be curious to hear both of your thoughts, it seems Stacker-esque because you can have essentially, like one of the things that it offers is granular permissions on bases. And that's very Stacker-esque, which is cool. I love seeing that functionality built into Airtable. But yeah, I mean, I all of these features are just insane to me. And it's crazy. I used to be this person that like didn't like working in Airtable. And I think I'm going to have to eat those words. Because I think I will like working in Airtable a lot because of all these enhancements that they're building into the program. And so props to Airtable, because this is amazing.
Hang on. How do you not like working in Airtable?
I'm going to put Ben on the spot here, but I know Ben was with me on this boat for a while.
I say that because like I love working in Airtable, and because I'm trying to get them to sponsor Wink, but I really do like being in Airtable, and it's like fun to me. It's like real. It to me, it's just like it's a visual database. So it's like, ooh, what more can I put in here? I don't know. You don't have to answer. It's fine.
I don't know if I have explicit reasons, Ben. What would you say? Like, I just like prefer Google Sheets.
So my reasoning back then was that I could do more in Google Sheets for less money. And it felt like Airtable was just what I was paying for was a more comfortable experience. So like it was like a styled spreadsheet, which is cool if you really care about that. And for a lot of people, it made it more approachable to like work with clients and get data in. I get that. Like I didn't have that where I needed that. And so for me, it's like, I can run scripts in Google Sheets, and I could do all kinds of wild, weird things that was really awesome. Like run scheduled scripts like at specific times that right. went in conjunction with Zapier flows, and it was wonderful. But now the Airtable has all of these features. Like right. The blocks was really cool, and yeah. That really turned my head where I was like, okay, I have to think about Airtable more, but having the automations, having the blocks, and now having, you know, all like the ability to sync, it's like, okay, I don't need Parabola to sync my Google Sheet with X anymore. Like if I can literally just sync two bases, cool. Like I can just, you know, it's one place to go. Like I, this last, once again, the blocks really turned my head. The last release really has me where I'm like, okay, I can see a clear case for Airtable way more than I could before, because like I said, that's one of the reasons I was so in love with Coda and still love Coda. Coda, I can write in these docs. I can create beautiful docs. But then if I want to create these bases and have them sync between the documents and do all kinds of weird things, like I can do all kinds of fun stuff there. And it's like, okay, now Airtable has this superpower, and it's got me thinking like, wow, I really am going to have to spend some time in Airtable, more time in Airtable, really playing with some of these features because they seem pretty incredible. So that was kind of where I was at with it, you know. Because it, like, once again, I felt like I was paying for like a styled spread. Like it was great and very approachable and had some really great pieces to it. But for me, it was like nothing that I needed or was winning me over from a product perspective.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess now that I think about it too, like it was the UI that just pulled me in and like, you know, love it so much. So yeah, it makes total sense.
There's something to learn here though. And I don't think we talk about this enough, but like if you're building a no-code app, what it looks like matters. Like if it looks good, there's like a trust and legitimacy that comes with it. And people are like, oh, this is like people like literally, I can't tell you how many times I've been on a call with people and they open an app and they're like, oh, this is legit. And you're like, yeah, just first glances, like it looks really good. And I mean, that was the other day. Me and Matt were on a call and I don't even know who I was on the call with. I opened up Alcida and somebody was like, oh, dang, that looks legit. And we need to actually, we're going to try to cover this on an upcoming episode, by the way, talk about Alcida versus MemberSpace versus MemberStack, kind of get into more details on some of these newer gated content tools. But I mean, there is like when your product looks good, it will win you users. So it has to be functional, obviously, but there is a win when it looks great. So anyway, congrats to the Airtable team. I thought that was really cool for them. And I think that, you know, when you hear them talk about it, just like reading some of the articles, they tweeted some slides from way, but like it was like 4 years ago or something, where they talked about how the no code revolution is coming. And they talked about some, like, this has been in the works for them for a while. And so I can only imagine the kind of elation and joy that brings for them. I'm really excited for their team to finally have that out. So looking forward to giving it a go. We'll have a more detailed episode soon, hopefully, on all of this. But there you go. Speaking of Airtable and Matt bringing up Stacker, we come to the Stacker app, and they've also been funded. They're a part of YC20, and they've also picked up investments from Initialized Capital and the Pioneer Fund. So shout out to Stacker. I think that's really cool. I am curious how today's announcement or this week's announcement impacts them, because I do think there are some similarities there. I still think Stacker has this unique approach between those and Salesforce about just putting a UI and a really slick look on top of things and making it easier. So
I think having that data, because like Airtable is in a sense like a UI, but it's still also a spreadsheet. And what Stacker does well is it literally abstracts at one more level and makes it a dashboard. And so it feels less like a spreadsheet and dealing with things line by line, and more like, oh, okay, this is just a user record or something that I'm seeing in like a normal web page. So I think there's definitely room for them, but I agree. I'm with you. I'm curious to see how they pivot, if at all. We need to have Sam and Michael on the podcast. We planned on that a few months ago, and I need to circle back with them and talk about it.
For sure. I'm curious about what next steps are for them. But I think a really obvious piece here is, like, people who are listening to this podcast, even they're going like, okay, JavaScript blocks and Airtable, cool. I can't write JavaScript. Like, that's where, like, I still think Stacker has this draw, right? Where it's like, okay, like I can build this dashboard, not write any code, really keep all my data in one place. It's easily accessible. And now I have automations I can run on top of it. So I don't know, pretty cool. But anyway, congrats to the Stacker team. I think it's really cool that they got funding. If you haven't checked them out, definitely go give them a look. Link in the show notes. And this is something I never thought I would say on this podcast, but If This Then That is the next one in line. They released If This Then That Pro, which allows you to do multi-step queries and conditional logic, multiple actions, and then faster execution of these apps or these I don't know what you want to call them, Zaps, these IFTs that you built. I don't know if they've got a name for them. I'm not an If This Then That user, but well, it's cool. If you wanted to try it out, if you're like, I used to use If This Then That like way back in the day, and I want to try it again, until October 7th, you can name your own price for If This Then That Pro. So if you want to go give it a shot, go give it a shot. If you're one of those people who's like, I just need these basic things, like I don't need this huge piece of back-end 40-step Zaps to do something, I'm just trying to X, Y, and Z, might be worth checking out. Definitely go give it a look. Link in the show notes. Notion. I'm excited to talk about this one. We talked about possibly the API is coming in the last episode. Now we have a tweet, link in the show notes, from somebody at Notion who says, yes, for real, the API is coming. They were looking for some feedback and some different pieces. So really excited about this. Definitely something you need to check out. But also, it looks like they've had some data issues recently where it looks like they exposed like name and email of every person who created like a Notion doc, whether it was, no matter what the privacy setting was.
Yeah, it's super weird because someone sent this to me. It was a Reddit thread. And essentially, so a user discovered that there was a chunk like in the network tab when you open up, like when you inspect the page and click the network tab and you have all the requests, there was like a low chunk of user data, like network requests. And in it, regardless of the page, you could have made a Notion page, made it publicly accessible, and like that could be floating around the internet. You can go to that network request and you can find the full name, email address, and all these other pieces of information about that user. And so in essence, nothing was really private. And I guess what ended up happening is the user contacted Notion before exposing it. And Notion was like, oh yeah, we're aware of this. Like it's intentional. And they're like, I think they were like, we're investigating, we should do anything. And so they didn't do anything. And so the user put it on Reddit and like that, the network request went away and they're like, oh, sorry about this. You know, we've removed that from our request. Let us know if you need anything. And so I think a little bit of public pressure there to remove private data was important, but just crazy to see something like that just like out in the open, especially from a big company like Notion.
Just goes to show you there are those little things everywhere that are saying, if you're security conscious or if you're not security conscious, it's things like this that make you go, maybe I should be more security conscious because,
right.
Definitely things to think about. So on top of that, we talked recently, we had like a mini breakdown at the front of during the no-code roundup where we talked about Zapier versus IntegraMAT. And so we've gone through a lot of, I feel like we've traveled a journey on automation tools in this podcast. And with personally, you know, for me, it was like Zapier, and then I found IntegraMAT, and then there's Parabola, there's all these, which I still, by the way, if you don't use Parabola, you're missing out. It's an incredible tool, and I love it, and there's so much joy that comes from using it. But, you know, when it comes to running those flows, I had kind of abandoned Zapier just because I felt like the price was high, but, you know, there were some things that it couldn't do. Specifically, it was array-related for me. Like, if I have groups of objects that I need to work with, Zapier is really not great at that. And without having to write a bunch of custom code or, you know, what have you. And so I started using IntegraMAT. But then I ran into a lot of issues, just frustrations. And I feel like for as powerful as IntegraMAT is, it does eat a lot of time for me. It's not as quick to build in as personally, it's the way I find it to go as, you know, than Zapier. So I've kind of reversed course, and my first pick is always Zapier. I just feel like it's so solid and it does a great job. And the only reason I'm going to zig off of that and use Integromat is because, you know, I have to break an array or do something where I have to loop through these issues. So then I'll go use Integromat. And so we talked about it a little bit. And one of the reasons we cited was the customer service as well. Like, you know, for me, Zapier, I reach out to customer service. I have a response like almost like it's so quick and really detailed. And for me, there's I know people talk about the Zapier price, but for me, customer service and having that response touch and that touch is really worthwhile and positive. And but we did get some feedback on this. Matt, do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah. So going back to that episode, just for a little bit of context for those that didn't hear it, you know, like I'm on the agency side of things. And one thing Ben and I were talking about in that episode is that I would not feel good putting a client on Integromat and like having them rely on customer service, because if they want to go the DIY route like later on down the road and they run into an issue, I feel much better putting them in Zapier customer service, which is amazing. I've experienced it myself, versus Integromat. And one thing I said was that I'm pretty sure I said that, you know, Integromat customer support would take forever to get back to you. And it's like pretty much not helpful. And I guess, I don't know if someone sent it to Integromat or if they just happen to be listeners of the podcast, but within a day or two of that episode releasing, we got a response from a staff member over there. And what they said, and like we had a very civil conversation about it, but they were just like, you know, we consulted the customer service database and it looks like your last three tickets, they've been responded to, two of them have been responded to within 12 hours and one of them within 1 hour. And I know for a fact that wasn't true. So I went to my email and I looked at the response time and it was not 12 hours. It was 19 days. And the response was, sorry for the delay. Do you still need help? And so it's not like, and like we had a, like I said, we had a very civil conversation. I told him, I was like, and Ben, you would understand this, being in a customer support role. I was like, I am empathetic towards the role of a customer support agent. I like know that customers suck. People suck. You have a lot of like tickets to answer, things like that. I totally understand that. But you also cannot be like, our customer service responds to you within an hour when it was like 19 days, because there's clearly an issue here. And that's the issue that we were talking about. It was a matter of, you know, responding in a timely manner. And that's a prime example of why I wouldn't feel right putting a client on Integromat right now, just because of the customer service aspect. That said, they told me that they are actively hiring new customer support champions. And they said they look forward to the day that we can talk about Integromat support and have a whole episode about how great it is. And I'm looking forward to that as well.
And listen, they upped that support game. I will scream about it from the rooftops. So, yeah, love it. Love that response. But did want to share that and appreciate you, Matt, for sharing that. So anyway, yeah, so that is our no-code roundup. So let's now jump into conversation for today, which is what we wanted to talk about, best build strategies for Webflow. And I, as someone who, once again, I've worked in support at Webflow, so I feel like I've seen a lot of different ways to build in Webflow and like a lot of different approaches. And, you know, you see a lot of different sites. There's a lot of things that you kind of glean from, but then also just like, as someone who's a Webflow nerd, just like when people share their Webflow creations, really diving into the inspector and really looking at, you know, how people did things and why they did things that way. Or like when somebody shares a preview link in the forum or wherever, if somebody makes a clonable, like I love opening those things up and really looking and seeing what other people do and how they do it and how they go about it. I'm a complete nerd for those sorts of things. I love seeing reverse engineering and just seeing what's happening. So, So anyway, so we wanted to spend some time talking about, I think all of us have some experience building, and all of us, I feel like all of us are pretty good with Webflow. And we've all, you know, had experience outside of Webflow creating. So we wanted to spend a little time talking about, like, okay, if you're going to build a Webflow site, what are the things that you should do right out the gate? Like, what are the things that you should be mindful of? So, Matt, Lacey, do you want to kick us off or?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to kick off by saying something that you taught me, which is using a style guide. I think that is a critical part of building a Webflow site efficiently. Because having all those things planned out, and I think a lot of that comes from having a good design and design system, which we'll talk about later. I think having a good design in Figma, translating a lot of those common components into a style guide that you can, you know, copy and paste and maybe turn into symbols, things like that. And like, you know, styling your body. So your H1s through H6s are all styled for you. You have a base font for everything and you're not assigning it by class. It's just literally the entire site has that font. I think setting all of that up in the beginning is such a critical part for your success. And not only in having like a non-bloated style sheet, but also in just like building sites so much quicker. So that'd be my first one. I'd be curious to hear your, both of your, go-tos.
I think for me, and this is something that I will get hung up on, and it's so simple, but like I will get lazy about it. And that is working from a basic wireframe. Like, even if you're like, I'm not a Figma person, I don't do that, I just know how to do Webflow. Like, go get a piece of paper and start drawing out everything, and like draw it out in boxes. Like that's what you're doing, is working with sections and containers and divs and all of that. And it really does save you so much time and gives you such a better look at what you're trying to build and the flow of the content, especially. And that's probably this next one actually probably should have been my first one, but that is understanding what content you're going to use before you even start. I have made massive mistakes with client work, with starting out in the like designing, developing phase without knowing exactly what the content's going to say. And I've gone back and had to redesign and redevelop time and time again over something that could have been solved like right off the bat. So like knowing what your content's going to say and then how that's going to flow and what it's going to look like in a very basic way is going to save so much time and effort and just headache.
That's a good point. I think both of those. So for me, it depends on what I'm building. But I am, and I think the beauty of Webflow is just content first. And so for me, especially if I'm building something where I'm using the CMS, I will have, now that I don't work in an office and I work at home, you're going to see me with sticky notes. If I had a whiteboard, I would be using a whiteboard. And I probably need to get a whiteboard for my home office, but that's where I like to start. It's sticky notes scrambled out on a large surface or on a wall. Like, okay, this is the collection. These are the fields. This is how it ties together. Here's how I can filter this to show exactly what I want to show. Like, I sit down and do the content math, which is like, you know, just what do I need? What content do they have? And I think too, it's also looking at what content will exist here. Like, what kind of sections do I need and what kind of copy needs to exist for that? And does it exist? And if not, who's writing it and how am I getting there? You know, for instance, like if I know almost every site you're going to want a call to action, are those pre-written? What does that look like? What do they want the user to do? You know, and it's hard to really design an experience when you're not sure what those end goals are. So I think it's really my favorite question. Like, people often ask me, like, hey, I'm trying to X, Y, Z, and I'm stuck on this thing. And my first question is always like, what are you trying to do? Like, that's my favorite question to ask, is what are you trying to accomplish? And then start from there. Like, okay, if that's what you're trying to accomplish, then these are the steps that you should take. And for me, it's really understanding that content. And I'm with you. I spend a lot of time, like, it's that gif of, what is his name? Charlie from Always Sunny, where he is like in the room and the corkboard's everywhere and the yeah. papers are posted up. And there's yes. yarn everywhere.
Yes.
That's me scheming out content of every build. I'm like literally like smoking the cigarette. I don't smoke a cigarette, but like that's what it feels like. I'm trying to figure out like, okay, master main look at things, like proper look at things. What is that big 30,000 foot view of the content? And then designing from there. And I do the same thing. I start with the style guide. And if you've not used Webflow before, it's not anything that's built into the product. Like, so essentially, I always, first step, create a new page. Set it to draft, because you can set pages as drafts. So it's never published, so people can't see it. So it doesn't show up in search results. But I set it as a draft. And then I start designing. And I have a template that I use, but like, you know, you can do it however you want, but all my headings out there, like Matt said, I select the body. I like to use a unit list line height, because it's the line height's dependent upon the size of the font. So it makes sure everything scales properly and line heights work properly. But I set that, set my fonts, I set my font sizes, you know, all that fun stuff, colors. And then I jump in, for me, it's like headings. Okay, I'm going to lay out all my headings, style, all headings, style, all paragraphs, style, all links, style. And then there is no all buttons, so I drop in buttons, and I do button primary, button with a combo class of secondary, button with trailing icon, button with leading icon, button outline, button, you know, whatever. However many buttons I feel like I need for the project, I kind of do all that. I like to add, like, warnings or call-outs, alert bars, pills, badges, all those things that I think the project might need. I try to style all that first. And I feel like people are always like, God, that sounds like a lot of work. And it really, it is. But what happens is, this is where the strategy comes into play. Because what happens is, if you don't do that, you start building and you put a div out there, a section, and it becomes section one. And, you know, then you put something inside it and you style a button in there and that becomes button. And then you have a button on another page and you don't necessarily reuse the class. You need a modified version of it where it's all. So you create another class and another class. And now you don't even know what all the classes that you have are. And you end up having, like Matt said, this really bloated style sheet, which is not good for load times. It's not good for your project performance and Webflow. So it's like, okay, I'm going to do all this. For me, I get really, like, I have a base class of section where all my sections have certain padding, and I have my container class, and I, you know, all these specific things that I reuse over and over. I try to make things as reusable as possible, because then when I start building, it's like, I put in a heading, the heading looks the way I want. I don't need to touch it. I put in a paragraph looks the way I want. I don't need to touch it. I put in a button class, and then button with leading icon. There's a button with an icon on it. I didn't have to do anything. Like, literally, I'm just adding classes to things and laying it out, as opposed to styling on the go. So, like, that for me is step one.
So, what would you say if, like, I will admit this, even though you purists, you know, say otherwise, but, like, I will get, you know, UI kits or templates and build off of them and build with them, like, especially if I'm trying to spin something up or just I'm not in, I can't design what I'm trying to do, right? So how would you approach continuing to build with a UI kit or with a template in a way that is like best practices, so you're not having, because like you can get conflicting styles really, really quickly.
Right.
What would you do there?
Yeah. So for me, this is where the best advice I can give you is to use it for guidance only. So like for me, and I've talked to Matt, and I have had this conversation. I think Matt and Lazy and I have had this conversation a lot. If people come to me and they're like, hey, I've got this Webflow project for you. Would love for you to work on it with me. And you're like, okay, great. What is it? Like, I'm trying to get a project over the finish line. And you're like, no, sorry. Hard no, not interested. One, those aren't fun anyway. But two, you know, the fun of Webflow is you get to build all these wild things, and it doesn't take a lot of time. But then three, the worst, absolutely worst thing you can do is spend your time trying to figure out how somebody else builds. Like, it's like, okay, what? They did what here? Like, that's not how I build. Like, they use their containers differently, or the way they use their class names, or the way they approach, like, oh, they use the actual columns, like, feature here? Like, no, I use grid, or, you know, I like flex, or, like, however you like to build. I feel like the hardest thing using those kits is just trying to figure out how they did it. So, for me, like, if I don't really buy UI kits much, I think I've bought one or two from – because it was specified from a client, like they wanted this X thing. But if I do it, I then rebuild what they built the way I would build it. So I can say, like, okay, here's my containers. It's the container class. So here's a card layout. Great. Okay. This is how I would name it. This is how I would build. I just look at their design on one monitor and I rebuild it on my project, so I can make sure my classes are the right. I don't have to worry about that copy paste conflicting class, because it is true. Like, you'll set your base, you'll have a container, you'll have a button. Well, guess what? When you paste from them, it's like they have a button, they have a container. So now you have container two, you have button two, you have, like, now it's like mass chaos, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria. And it, like, I can't live in that world. So for me, it's always like, I just use it as the visual cue. And I rebuild. That's personally how I do it.
Yeah, that's interesting, because sometimes, and I don't know if you're supposed to do this, but I do it. But, like, sometimes I'll go, if I'm, like, looking at a template and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. How'd they do that? So, you know, you just go open it up in the designer, and then you can just expose the whole thing. And then you're like, oh, I can just look at what they did and go rebuild it. And I feel kind of bad for it, but not terribly, because the functionality is there. But, like, I'm the opposite. So I can see how they did it and then realize, like, oh, they used columns for this. Well, I'm like, especially after you showed me that whole grid thing of, like, why I, you know, how I was using it wrong. Like, it's like, oh, well, then I'm just going to get it and then repurpose it and, like, figure out how to do it in grid or whatever. But I start there so often. So it made me think of, like, what are better ways? Cause, like, I have conflicting styles all the time, or something's built and it's like, I know it's like, I wouldn't probably do it that way for whatever reason, or yeah, that is a really good way to build it, something. So I was just super curious.
Yeah. And that's where I buy the kit. I'll just buy it for the client. So whoever built it gets their money, but then I just rebuild it. Cause it's easier to do it that way for me. And I think that, one is a key, is just like having a system on how you build. Like, do you use grid? Do you use Flexbox? How do you use them? Do you know when you're using them the right way? And, like, you know, kind of going about that, being really picky about how, I think part of it is, like, you have to be defensive or picky about what's in your project and how it works. Like, you have to kind of be like, no, I'm not, I will rebuild this before I do this. Right. So, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, I think the only other option there is, because I hate that copy paste issue, because that's a big thing. And if you start copying and pasting things, you're going to have container, container two, container, your div block. And this is actually a problem with, like, or this is a problem that style guides help mitigate. Instead of doing div 354, like we see on a lot of sites, you have just a single container. And it's so much more efficient. I go crazy when I see a site in the forum or something like that that's just like, they just use Webflow default styling. But going back to the point, I think the other option is, if you're not too far along in your project and you buy someone else's UI kit, you could, if they have a style guide, you could just start adding to theirs instead of vice versa. But I think there is also, what Ben said is very true. It's like, when do I use certain things? And I think if I was a, like, if I'm listening to this and I'm like, oh, I'm a beginner just starting out, I would want to learn the fundamentals first and then maybe go that route. But otherwise, I would, like, just try to want to build things myself and learn from my mistakes and go from there.
Yeah, it's hard because, I don't know. For me, like I said, trying to dig through how somebody else builds and match that can just be super difficult. Because what happens, you're, like, trying to bend something to your will and you start just muscle memory doing things the way you would do it. And you're like, oh, That's not how they did it. Okay. That completely breaks it. Let me go back this other way. But I, you know, for me, that's it. I think another key, another area where people struggle is they design or build in the CMS. So like they'll put their CMS list out there, like they'll have put in all their content, it's great, or they'll have DOMI content because they know what the content's going to be. It's just on the way, right? And they put CMS list on the page, and then they start designing in the list. Well, now you want to reuse that element. Guess what? Sorry, it's bound. Like, so now you have to like make a copy of the list, unbind everything, copy that element, put it somewhere else. So I always, on my style guide page, I have components too. Like I build, like if I know I'm going to use cards, I'm going to build my card there. And then if I'm going to use lists, I'm going to build my list there. If I'm going to use these specific sections or whatever, I'm going to build it all there, like in its base form. And then I can copy and paste that into each list and then just bind it. And so I typically try to do that. In fact, I have a project I start from that has like sections with cards, sections with like stacked lists, sections with like all these different pieces that I know that gets commonly their common UI patterns. And, I will just reuse those. I paste them in, style them, or literally like when I get my style guide created, it conforms to the style of the project for the most part, based on, you know, how we set colors and fonts and all those things. And then I can fine tune it to really match. But I think that's really key too, is like really knowing like, okay, what elements am I going to need? Because when it comes down to it, you see a lot of really cool creative sites and you can do some off the wall things, but like, I think that, in the end, websites follow the box model, right? Like you're not going to get out of that. And so there's a lot of similarities site to site, that you're going to end up using. So I don't know, for me, that's there. I think another thing is, for me, that a common thing, refrain I see, like when people, DM me on Twitter and ask for help, or DM me like in the forums or like whatever, is just styling responsively while you're building. I think the worst thing that you can do is build this whole page and, or build multiple pages and never once jump down to the smaller breakpoints. Then you're like, oh crap, how is this going to work? And so I think really understanding, like as you build, thinking about what is this going to look like on mobile? Am I going to stack these elements? Can they stay side by side? Are they going to be too big? And really while you're building, just go ahead. Like I build a section before I move to the next section, I make that section responsive. And then I jump back up to the main breakpoint and I do it again. And I go section by section even, because I don't want to get too far out and realize I'm going to have problems on mobile or what have you, because I want my styles to be, and this is where it goes back to content. I want my styles to be similar. If I need font to be a little smaller because I know there's a lot of content here, but keep things from overflowing or breaking or, what have you. And really, I think another trick to having good, like, I don't know if you guys do this, but like when I get on mobile breakpoints, I'll change my font size to like VW. So like as the screen gets larger, my text scales appropriately. So it all kind of works, but that's another. What other tricks do you guys use to make sure your Webflow site is like on point?
I think going back to the style guide, one thing you might have mentioned it, Ben, but setting colors as global swatches, I think is important, because just having, like, it's going to suck if you're going to have to go back into Figma and pull in color code A3D612 or something like that. Yeah, I'm never going to remember that. And I'm always going to have to keep going back into Figma if I don't save it as a swatch. And when I save it as a global swatch, it's nice. I can literally change it. Like if I choose one place, if I change it in that one place, it'll change across the entire site if I would like to, if there was some brand change that I need to do. But swatches, I think, is a big one for me.
Yeah, I agree. So, and I'm putting you both on the spot. What would you say, if you can, is your biggest mistake that you've made when it came to setting up or developing something that you're like, oh, if I could spare somebody this, it would be, don't do this.
I think mine is not using a style guide. I like literally cannot emphasize that enough. I learned it from Rand Segal on like using a style guide in the Webflow masterclass. And because every time I would open a Webflow project back in the day, it would just be like, all right, and what I would do is, oh, I was so stupid. I started designing in Webflow. And I think some people have the chops for that. My brain is just not, like, I'm barely good at design as is. And to go into Webflow and start actually, like, trying to design without knowing what my site should look like, without doing any of this wireframing stuff, or without knowing the content, things like that, I would just jump right in, you know, and be naive and try to build. And so going to Figma is super helpful. Building your style guide is super helpful. Knowing what content you're going to put on the page, it's important to know that if you're going to build a page that actually converts. I think those are like my top three for sure.
I don't know. This is harder because I've been using Webflow since 2014 and I feel like I'm pretty decent at Webflow at this point. So I don't know. Not that I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect, but I can't think of big things. I guess the worst thing you can do is get ahead of yourself on the content. I think that's probably the biggest mistake. We talked about that a little, but there's nothing worse than like putting your content together and realizing you need another field and then having to use Parabola to like pull out all the content and add this next extra column and then slap it back into Webflow. And now you have to like add another piece into all of your collections, and really having that defined before you get there, I think is a huge win. There are other things that you can do really like, there are common things I see, like people will say things like, you know, I just wish Webflow would load a little faster, but like they're loading 4 Google fonts and it's like, okay, well don't do that. Like, most of the times you don't need as many weights as you think you do. Like people will like include 8 weights and you know, you don't need that. The number one tip I tell you is don't even load the fonts from Google. If there's a Google font you want, go to fonts.google.com and download the fonts and then upload them to your Webflow project. And now you're not waiting on Google to load it. It's being loaded by Webflow. It's going to load quicker. It's going to be a smoother experience. You know, convert them to make sure you got them in the WAF format, right? Instead of, you know, OTF or TTF, and then upload them to Webflow. Like, you know, those sorts of things. Thinking about your interactions. Interactions are cool, but like, what does it look like in Safari? Safari and interactions is like WebKit, and how it handles it is completely different. If you have an interaction that is drawn out and longer, it will stutter in Safari. Like, are you thinking about those things? Like, the worst thing you can do is build a whole project and just looking at Chrome or just in Safari and never open it in Firefox or Chrome or any other browser. Like, as you're building, if you're like, this is damn cool, and you've got this cool page started, you've got 2 sections, open it up in other browsers and then go, oh, open it up on a phone. What does it look like on a phone, right? Like, it's those sorts of things that I think are super helpful. You know, really, like, dialing that in. I think another thing to understand is like when you add external scripts, it impacts the performance of your site. If you're loading Google Analytics, guess what? It slows it down. This is why Fathom Analytics, if you're not a Fathom Analytics user or fan, highly recommend. Really, really good. Loads much quicker, privacy based, really worth using. But like, use that. If you're calling a bunch of libraries, can you find a way to combine some of those things and some of those scripts and serve them in one script from one place on a CDN? You know, I think that's super useful. A trick that I use that I don't think people use very much, this is not necessarily a Webflow trick, but this is a custom code trick. You know, sometimes you have these elements, right? And you're like, okay, it's a video element and I know it sucks on desktop. It's going to like eat a bunch of bandwidth, but I've made it as performant as possible and looks good. The problem is on mobile, I can hide it, but it's still being loaded. You know, okay, well, what can you do? Well, like, I don't know if you're a JavaScript user, but you can say like below this breakpoint, I have a script. I'll try to share it in my snippets, get it to my snippets and share it for this episode. But where you can say, find the element and remove it. Like on low page load, just like, as it's like, let's get rid of it. Let's not load it. Let's hide, like, not, we're not just hiding it. Let's just blast the thing out. Like, we don't even want to load the thing, right? Like, you can do those sorts of things that are really tricky and are fun ways of thinking about, like, how can I increase my performance? So I don't know. It's all those things. I would say lazy load, but Webflow default lazy loads images now, which is beautiful. So that's a big one too. I think that, you know, not having to load all those things up front, but it's just those little things when you're building. And then if you're not somebody who builds on Webflow a lot, you're like, okay, I really need to up my game. Watch the Webflow University videos and don't think so much about how they're teaching a concept. I mean, you want to learn that too, but at the same time, watch how they build section, container. Like, there's a certain order that they follow, and there's a certain way that they build things, and there's a certain best practice you can pick up just by watching them build, because it's like, hey, there's always a section in a container, and there's always X, and it's always like this. They're teaching you by showing you this over and over again. And so, like, picking up those little best practice hacks and tricks, I think are really powerful too. So lots of fun little things that you can do to really make sure your Webflow site is like the best it can possibly be. So this is where I would also say, like, there's a couple other custom code pieces that I use on the regular. One of them is to make sure long pieces of text on mobile don't overflow the side, the word breaking, because it's not native in Webflow. And then another one is, like, there's a huge argument between designers. In fact, I think Matt probably uses this and I don't. It's the font aliasing. Like, everybody automatically includes that font aliasing. But basically, it can help sometimes, but you're also you're overriding the system and telling it how it should render fonts. And sometimes I think you're also probably hurting yourself too. So there's an argument either way. But those are the common things that people use on a regular basis.
I know what's Ben, I don't trust any computers to do it. I know all.
No, I only say that because, like, even inside, like, there's never been a place I've been where there's not an argument for and against. I hear it all the time, you know. So, but the other thing I would say is, like, common sticker images too, right? Like, images are a big thing. If your assumption is I'm going to export this image and then I'm going to put it in Webflow and they have responsive images, and so it's just going to fix it for me, that is not how that works. There's some compression that happens on the Webflow side. It does an incredible job. But if you're serving a 3 megabyte image, it's not going to save you anything, right? So you have to make sure, like, get your images into Photoshop or Figma. Figma free. You can export out of there and then use a tool after you export, use a tool like TinyPNG, compress that image and get it as small as you possibly can, and then upload to Webflow and watch it do its magic. You know, I think people rely too much on just like, oh, Webflow is going to automate that. Don't do that. Like, really prep your images and take those right steps. Use SVGs when you can. You know, SVGs are vector-based graphics. They're going to be smaller. They're going to load quicker. They're going to scale better. It's going to be much better for you. And you can do a lot with those, you know. And so I think it's those little things, like, how do I even think about my images and prepping those and making sure they're in a good state so that when I get them in my project, they're going to load quickly. Like, it's so important for you to, like, kind of have those top of mind, because it matters. It matters when you start adding it up. When you have a collection and you know you're going to show a thumbnail, it's annoying to have two different images in the CMS, but have a thumbnail and to have a smaller images. If the card is at best going to be 200 pixels wide, you don't need an image larger than 200 pixels in the thumbnail. Like, why would you do that? It's never going to be any bigger, you know. And so you can save yourself a lot of load time, especially if you're pulling a lot of data. So it's just those little things that you can do when you're working with Webflow that really are going to end up saving your bacon, right? Like, they end up making your life a whole lot easier. Avoid icon fonts. Don't do that. Like, once again, you're now loading another font. They're not accessibility friendly. They're not always translated the way you want they should be translated. They have a lot of room for failure. You know, use SVGs where you can, right? So I think those are important things to keep in mind.
I think my last one, which is much simpler in comparison, to all the great ones you just listed, cleaning up your unused styles. Because that you'll have them no matter how efficient you are, you will have unused styles, and literally Webflow makes it so easy to get rid of it. So do that. That'll help improve your style sheet and therefore your load times.
Yeah. And then my last one, my parting gift will be quick find. Command E or Control E or Command K. I use Command K. It works the same. It brings up that box that is where you can, it's like being on a Mac. You can search for elements and you hit enter and it adds it on the page where, yeah, if you have a div selected and you want to add a heading inside it, select the div, Command K, heading, hit enter, boom, it's on the page. In fact, there's a Webflow quick tutorial from Greamer recently that shows, it's like 15 seconds long, I think, it shows you how to use quick find. It's amazing. Plus you can find elements on the page. If you're like, I'm looking for an element with this class name, or I'm looking for, is there an embed on this page? K, you know, Command K, start typing embed. It'll even show you like with a little mouse icon, oh, this exists on the page. Pull that up for me. So it just makes you a lot more efficient when you're building. So.
Yeah. I think when I was thinking kind of like, I think a lot of us, or I do this, I shouldn't speak for anybody, but I just want to get in and start building. And I am so impatient with the process and with myself and with, you know, whatever. It's like, no, I just want to go. But spending that extra time on the front end and setting everything up correctly and like working through some steps with content and design and wireframes, the whole thing, setting up your style guide, everything that was just mentioned, really does save you so much time on the back end. And it's like, you can't really cheat the process because you're going to pay for it one way or another. So you're going to pay, like, it's just going to be a much better experience to do things the right way than try and, you know, check off some boxes that you didn't really do and think that you somehow got ahead, because it's really not going to be the best for you. Or if you're turning it over to a client, you know, you're not building with the best knowledge and best product to hand them.
That's brilliant. Yeah. There's going to be debt to pay one way or the other. You can pay it up front or you can pay it in the end whenever you're finished. And it's much easier to just kind of eat that cost up front. And one thing I will say, you build a handy style guide, no more new project. Just duplicate your style guide over and over and over again and work off of it. Because guess what? You already have a style guide. Just go through it, add your colors and your fonts. Boom. You know, you already have components built. You can just start using those, save them as symbols. Empowers you to do a lot. But hopefully this little chat has been helpful to people who are looking to up their Webflow game. And some of these tips and tricks and things we mentioned will be useful. But we appreciate you hanging out and listening. Any parting words, Matt, Lacey?
Use a style guide. I'm going to say that till the day I die. Put it in my grave.
Use the style guide.
Use Ben's. Bug him for his.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for hanging out. Really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll be back again next week with another new episode. And like I said, we've got some fun things coming. So looking forward to it. But thanks for hanging out, and we'll talk to you soon.
Deuce. Bye.
Thanks for listening to visualdev.fm. You can find us on your favorite social media platform at visualdev.fm.